A few days after the election, the Obamas appeared on 60 Minutes. I watched the segment from the rehab center where my father, who had been gravely ill, was recuperating. My mom was on one side of my father's bed, and I was on the other as we watched our newly elected president and first lady in awe. They were as relaxed and down-to-earth as the couple I had met 17 years earlier. At the end of the interview, my mother looked over at me. "How did you know that he could win?" she said. "Not that he would, but even that he could." "Because of you two," I said, a bit of surprise in my voice. "Because you both raised me to believe that if you work twice as hard as anyone else and sacrifice for what you believe in, and luck is on your side, the sky's the limit." She shook her head and said softly, "I never believed any of that." My dad chuckled and he said he agreed with her. I stared at them in disbelief. For the first time, I realized my parents raised me aspirationally, instilling in me a set of core beliefs that they didn't actually hold themselves. Their gift to me was not to shackle me with their reality, but to prepare me to own the full potential of mine. Chapter 9. Drinking from a Fire Hose. I woke up at the crack of dawn on February 22, 2008, during the campaign in a hotel room in Austin, Texas. As usual, I had no idea which hotel I was in or my room number. It was the morning after one of Barack's primary debates with Hillary Clinton. I looked over at the telephone, searching for our hotel's name, more out of curiosity than necessity. I hit the gym for a quick workout and read the press releases from the debate while walking briskly on the treadmill. Afterward, I grabbed a quick bite to eat with Eric Whitaker, who was traveling with us, and he and I piled into the service elevator to wait for Barack. At 7:30 sharp, Barack sauntered in, mumbling a barely audible hello. I smiled to myself about his punctuality, but have I mentioned that Barack is not a morning person? I am, and it took me a while to learn to modulate my chipper morning voice until he'd been up for a while. That day, Barack had a cold, so he was even quieter than usual. An older black man was operating the hotel elevator, and once we were all in and heading down, he cleared his throat to speak. "Oh no," I thought, holding my breath, "this is not the time to strike up a conversation." "Senator," he said, "I'd like to give you a gift." Since I'm nosy, I peered around Barack's shoulder to see what it was. It was a patch from a military uniform. Recognizing what it was, Barack said, "Oh, sir, I couldn't possibly accept that." "No," the gentleman said, "I insist." They went back and forth a few times until finally he said to the senator, "Sir, I've carried this patch with me every day for 40 years. It has given me the courage to defend our country. It has given me the strength to go through some extremely tough times. And I want you to have it," he added with a smile. Barack thanked him and gave him a signed copy of Dreams from My Father. He often gave out copies to thank people for their help along the campaign trail. The whole thing was too much for me. I immediately burst into tears. I don't mean a few drops. I was heaving and sobbing and tried to muffle the noise in the small elevator. Eric cried too, but more quietly. For the rest of the day, I kept thinking about what the man had done, trying to imagine how Barack processed such an act of selflessness. This was long before people started handing him their babies to hold as they crowded to the front of rope lines. Later that afternoon, when Barack and I had a quiet moment alone together, I asked him what he did with the patch. He said he put it in his pocket. Typical guy, I thought, absent-mindedly stowing away this precious object. "No," I said, "I mean, how did it make you feel?" "Valerie, I put it in my pocket," he responded. Then he reached into his pocket and took out about 10 or 11 other trinkets and keepsakes. "I put it in my pocket with these." He then proceeded to tell me the story behind each one, the name of the person who had given it to him, if he knew it, where they were at the time, and why it was special enough for him to carry it around. He looked at them each night when he emptied his pocket and again as he put the items back in the next morning. To this day, he selects a few from among the many he received over the course of his public life, depending on his mood and need for inspiration, to keep him company each day. after the president was sworn in, I reflected back often on the people we'd met on the campaign trail. That man in the elevator, Ashley in South Carolina, 112-year-old black woman waiting patiently in a rope line, Johannes in Iowa, Edith Childs, who began the Fired Up, Ready to Go chant in South Carolina. I used their stories to show the sacrifices people were willing to make to be a part of a movement. And on my first day of work at the White House, I decided to use the story of the man from the elevator we met that day in Austin as a way to keep myself grounded and remind me why we were there. On a typical morning at the White House, I would arrive well before sunrise, and as my car idled, waiting for the Secret Service gate to raise, I would take a moment to look up at the Washington Monument, rising majestically above the tree line, south of the White House grounds. I would watch the light at the top of the monument blink three times, then close my eyes and say to myself, "Remember, you only have the privilege of being here because of people like that man who gave a struggling candidate his military patch, so focus on making him proud today." Tom Brokaw had been the first to call it. Early on in the campaign, he told me, "If your friend wins, your life will never be the same." A mutual friend had introduced us at a dinner at RL, one of my favorite restaurants in Chicago. I'd admired Tom Brokaw for as long as I could remember, but I told him the idea of my life changing was not likely. I already had a great life in Chicago. Then, the Thursday after the election, my cell phone rang. It was Tom Brokaw. "I want to congratulate you on your friend's incredible victory," he said. "Do you remember when I told you 18 months ago how your life would change? How about we begin this Sunday with you coming on Meet the Press?" I had done national television at the convention and then again on election night, but nothing with nearly as high a bar as the most popular Sunday morning show in the country. My stomach started its usual churning, but after talking it over with Barack, I agreed to fly to D.C. to appear on the program. Walking onto the set, sitting at that famous desk I had seen countless times on my own TV, watching the countdown clock tick down, I was scared out of my wits. Tom, seeing my expression, reached over to me, put his hand on top of my hand, and said, "Valerie, I'm not going to ask you any question to which you don't know the answer. Relax and let's have some fun." Oh boy, did I ever. I forgot about the millions of people watching back home, and my nervousness melted away, and I felt as though it was just Tom and me having a casual chat. Perhaps a little too great. On the way back to my hotel, my cell phone rang. It was Barack. "Were you flirting with Tom Brokaw?" he asked. "Maybe just a little," I said. At that point, Meet the Press seemed like it might be the high-water mark of my participation in Barack and Michelle's political life, though people had been trying to make me think otherwise for months. At the Democratic convention in Denver, Michelle's brother Craig had said to me, "You know you're going to have to go to Washington with them. They're going to need a friend who's willing to look out for them." I was touched by his sentiment, but to move away from my family, leave my CEO job and other board commitments just to be the first friend, when I could do that by flying into D.C. regularly from Chicago, didn't make sense to me. Then, further into the general election, Barack and I were alone during a long flight, discussing how well the home stretch of the campaign was going, and he said, "If I win, I'm going to ask you to come with me." "I didn't want to jinx it. Let's wait to talk about it after you win," I replied. But after Meet the Press, I still had no clear indication of what role I might play in the White House. My goal during the campaign had been to help Barack win the election, not to get a job in his administration. Besides, by then, I was eyeing political office myself. A few weeks before Election Day, I'd gone to an event honoring Bishop Arthur M. Brazier, pastor of the Apostolic Church of God, a megachurch located in the Woodlawn neighborhood of Chicago, just south of Hyde Park. An iconic civil rights leader and one of Brock's earliest supporters, Bishop Brazier was also my dear friend, and we had spent years working together on the redevelopment of Woodlawn. I sat on the dais for several hours with Dick Durbin, who early in the evening said to me, "When Barack wins, why don't you throw your name in the hat?" Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich was going to appoint Barak's replacement in the Senate, and Senator Durbin wanted to recommend me. I was ambivalent, but he went on to make a compelling case for why I should think about doing this. With Barak in the White House and the Democrats in control of the Senate, Majority Leader Harry Reid could use another person he could trust from the president's home state. I was also a lawyer, so understanding the legislative process would be easy. "You're perfect for the job," Senator Durbin said, "and I'll support you." It was an intriguing pitch, but it wasn't until after the election, while contemplating my future, that I came back around to the idea. I understood the job of a senator, unlike the White House, where I didn't have a clear sense of what my role might be. Whatever I was going to do, the pressure to make a decision was mounting. A couple of days after the election, I received a call from the head of one of Illinois' local unions, who'd reached out to say that he had an intriguing idea to discuss with me. The president-elect, I loved the sound of that title, had asked me to be one of three co-chairs of his presidential transition team, so I had no time to spare. I asked the leader to come for an early morning meeting at the temporary transition headquarters in our friend John Rogers' office while we waited for the official transition office to be ready. At our meeting, this union leader told me he'd heard that I might be interested in the Senate position and wanted to gauge my interest. He also said he'd heard that Blagojevich was interested in nominating me, but that he, who was at the end of his second term, wanted to be appointed Secretary of Health and Human Services. I laughed at the idea that Blagojevich could be appointed to any spot in the Obama administration. It was a non-starter as far as I was concerned. Moreover, we were already aware from the press that a federal investigation was casting a cloud over the governor. "That's ridiculous," I said. "Hey, don't shoot the messenger," the union had replied. Blagojevich was eventually convicted in a wide range of corruption schemes, including trying to use the offer of the Senate seat in exchange for a job for himself. What I didn't know at the time was that the Obamas already had other plans for me. Michelle suggested to her husband, "Make her a concrete offer so she knows what you have in mind for her specific responsibilities. Being your friend or a generic senior advisor will not be enough." So he asked his organizational genius, Pete Rouse, to think through what would make sense given my skill set. After Pete offered his recommendation, the president-elect called me at a hotel room in New York where I had flown after meet the press for a business meeting. He began by saying, "I know the Senate and I know you. You belong in the White House with me. You'll be happier and Michelle and I will be happier." He then offered me the position of White House Senior Advisor and Assistant to the President for Intergovernmental Affairs and Public Liaison, which we later renamed Public Engagement. A wordy, cumbersome title, but what it meant was that I would continue to give him my opinion and assistance wherever I could be helpful as a senior member of his team, and I would also oversee the White House offices responsible for relationships with our nation's governors, mayors, attorneys general, and state legislators, essentially all of the elected officials in America except for members of Congress. I would also be the gateway through which a wide range of advocates and businesses, as well as ordinary citizens, could engage with the White House. Giving state and local elected officials a voice in Washington and bridging citizens to the highest level of government? Who could ask for a better job? In fact, after I hit the ground running, I often joked with President Obama that my job was far better than his. I accepted the position on the spot, but as is life, a bit of drama followed. Rahm Emanuel, the president-elect's newly named chief of staff, had other ideas. Rahm was very open with me about the difficulty of having Hillary Clinton so involved in her husband's administration. That experience left him wary of having anybody in the White House closer to the president than he. Rahm is a longtime Chicago politico, and we'd always been friendly, having worked closely together when he was vice chairman of the Chicago Housing Authority Board. My boss, Daniel Levin, had also been a big contributor to Rahm's congressional campaigns. I had felt comfortable enough with him to solicit his endorsement of Barak during the 2008 presidential primary campaign. It was a tricky piece of business since his relationship to the Clintons went way back. Over lunch with Rahm at the East Bank Club during the heated primaries, I'd really pushed it hard, but he didn't want to get involved. "I'm just holed up under a table," he said, laughing. I understood and laughed too. As we walked out of the club's restaurant, who walked in? Barack Obama. He chuckled at the sight of us, asking, "Valerie, have you been pressuring this guy?" Rahm wasn't the only person to throw cold water on the idea of my joining the administration. After the Democratic convention in August, while Barack was campaigning in Las Vegas, he set up a meeting with a group of former Democratic presidential chiefs of staff to ask for their counsel. If he won, he wanted to be prepared. One person who joined the meeting via a conference call offered this piece of advice: "Don't bring any of your friends from Chicago." I thought he must be talking about me. I'd experienced plenty of infighting and jockeying for power in City Hall. I said to Barack, "Look, he's your chief of staff, and he is clearly uncomfortable with me. I've worked with people like that before, and I don't want to do it again." Having sat through many stories from me about my City Hall days, Barack already knew exactly what I was talking about. "I guarantee to you that I will have your back," he said. "You're not going to have that problem in my White House." "Given how Rahm feels, yes, I will." "No, you won't." I said yes, but an uneasiness lingered. 2 days later, on my 52nd birthday, after a last-minute effort by Rahm to scuttle my appointment, President-elect Obama publicly announced that I would be joining his White House team. Not a bad birthday gift from a dear friend who was about to become the most important man in the world. I brought in the best people I knew to help. Michael Strautmanis organized my offices during the transition, and I had known all along that he'd be perfect as my chief of staff. Having worked with him so closely throughout the campaign, I knew his work ethic and core values, as well as his longstanding relationship with the Obamas. To run my intergovernmental affairs office, I brought in Cecilia Munoz, a Detroit native with Bolivian parents who had supervised legislative and advocacy efforts at the National Council of La Raza, now known as Unidos U.S., the country's largest Latino advocacy group. Because of her credibility with immigration advocates, she also headed up our efforts in immigration. She was reluctant at first, a mom of two teenage girls, but I assured her I completely understood her priorities and we would make it work. And to serve as director of public engagement, I hired Tina Chin, a tough-as-nails, fearless former litigation partner at the Chicago office of Skadden, Arp, Slate, Meagher & Flom, with a national reputation as an advocate for gender equity. Tina wasn't used to losing any battles, and I knew we shared the same work ethic and values. In a coffee shop in the Aon Center in Chicago, with Susan Schur there to back me up, I gave Tina all of the reasons why, despite her comfortable life and lucrative career in Chicago, she should join me in D.C. to work in the White House, to which she simply replied, "You had me at hello." Inauguration Day was bitter cold, even worse than the day Barack announced his candidacy. But the moment when I walked out of the door of the Capitol, I literally gasped and held Laura's hand tightly. We saw people filling every square inch of the mall. The depth and breadth of the crowd was overwhelming. An estimated 1.8 million people, the largest crowd ever at any event held in Washington, D.C., showed up from across the country and around the world for this historic moment. Laura and I sat a few rows back on the platform, close enough to see Barack and Michelle's expressions as she held the Lincoln Bible while he took the oath of office. I tried to imagine what they were thinking. My thoughts were of the people, like my parents, who for so long feared this journey was impossible. Our country had turned an important page, and optimism and pure joy filled the frigid air. As the Obamas watched the parade from the viewing stand in front of the White House, I was inside moving into Hillary Clinton's and Karl Rove's former West Wing office. Because I hadn't asked ahead of time where it was, I had to wander around the halls of the first and second floors until I found my name placard by the door of a spacious office on the second floor. I went to the window to check out my view. The parapet around the building came up so high that it obscured almost my whole view, except for a bit of the Washington Monument and the sky. I guess the design was for safety concerns, a sobering reminder on my first day. The decor was bleak, so I went scavenging through the empty offices for some additional furniture. I took a desk from one person's office and a couch from somebody else's. First come, first serve. Nothing really matched, but I didn't feel the need to make my office any fancier than it was. Several times over the next 8 years, various people in operations offered to repaint my office's dingy yellow walls or upgrade the furniture, but I never took them up on it. It was privilege enough just to occupy any office in the West Wing. It didn't matter what it looked like, but it did matter to me what I did there. One of my roles was to be a bridge, broadly speaking, between the voices inside and outside of the White House. The two offices I ran served as the primary point of contact between the executive branch and all elected officials other than of Congress, advocacy groups, experts, and other stakeholders, including the general public. And to do that effectively required us to listen and engage, the same skill set I had honed when people like Mrs. Adams showed up at the mayor's office, or when I tackled redevelopment in Chicago's neighborhoods and worked on transit services in Chicago. Whether it was meeting with the LGBTQ activists about the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and their inclusion in federal job discrimination guidelines, or with civil rights activists about reforming the criminal justice system, or reaching out to a governor after a natural or man-made disaster, we were there to ensure the federal government was meeting the needs of the people on the ground. In the Office of Intergovernmental Affairs, we set the task of introducing ourselves to as many of the nation's mayors, governors, and other elected officials as possible. The president wanted them in the loop, and so we took their pulse on every issue. My phone line was always open to call me directly so that they could cut through the bureaucracy. If we were working on any piece of legislation that had an impact in a state, we touched base with the governors to see how they felt about it. That included everything from funding for affordable housing to Arne Duncan's Race to the Top education strategy to our campaign to end homelessness for veterans. On healthcare reform, given the impact that Medicaid expansion and the insurance exchanges would have, I worked closely with the governors to ensure their voices were heard. The Office of Public Engagement was originally started under President Richard Nixon as a point of contact between the White House and lobbyist groups. But we designed the office to interact with all people, not just special interest groups. To start out, Tina Chin tracked 60-plus buckets of constituency groups, all represented by robust national organizations. Categories ranging from progressive labor unions to business associations, from African American, Asian American and Pacific Islander, Hispanic, military families, women, and LGBTQ, to faith community, and from people with disabilities, to everyone's favorite assignment, celebrities and athletes. We were the first point of contact for any of these people trying to navigate the bureaucracy of the executive branch or advocate for a policy in the federal government. That ranged in scope from someone concerned about their small business, getting relief from flood damage, to advocates trying to reform the criminal justice system. And the relationship went both ways. We called upon our constituents when we needed a sounding board for policy initiatives or our legislative agenda. So, for example, when we were trying to decide which bill to push through Congress first, women's rights groups were instrumental in advocating for the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. The first 6 months were a blur of 18-hour days. In the wake of the financial crisis triggered by the collapse of Lehman Brothers in September of 2008, housing foreclosures had skyrocketed. The big banks were on the verge of a chain reaction collapse, and two of the three largest U.S. automobile companies were in bankruptcy. We were dealing with a global economic crisis while trying to stay focused on our policy priorities and staffing up the administration. We all said it was like drinking from a fire hose. None of us had a chance to settle in. Maybe every new administration feels like that. I'd found an apartment and moved to D.C. so quickly that my movers packed up a trash can still filled with garbage. Boxes stayed piled up in my living room so long that I finally just covered them with a large blanket to avoid the daily reminder. One of the few boxes I did unpack was the one with photos of Laura. I didn't have time to buy a hammer or nails, so I put my little pumpkins, as I call the images of her from various ages, along the floor. My apartment soon also became littered with binders, each one stuffed with briefing papers for the president and his senior staff. I stayed up late into the night, reading every single one and drafting many of my own. I was used to working hard, but now I was doing it on the biggest and most public stage in the world. I wasn't just dealing with the familiar pressures of being a Black woman in a professional setting. I was also a close friend of the president's. Though I rarely said it out loud, I knew the stakes were higher for the first Black president and first lady. The pressure that caused motivated me to try to do my best every day because I felt that any misstep by me would reflect poorly on them. At first, I used my voice judiciously, knowing that it carried greater weight because people assumed that I had an inside track to the president's thoughts. Anytime I did a press interview, I spent hours thinking of every possible question and forced our already overworked press office to go through multiple practice sessions with me. I gained a reputation for trying to be overprepared to the point that when the West Wing ran low on binders for the briefing memos, a staffer politely asked if I wouldn't mind returning a few. But overpreparing paid off. I felt confident in my opinions, and though I used it carefully in the beginning, I had found my voice in the most important building in the country. I convinced Susan Shura to not only accept a job offer in the White House counsel's office, but also to move into an apartment across the hall from me. She was a natural fit for the healthcare team, given her experience as general counsel at the University of Chicago Medical Center, but it meant she had to move away from her husband, Neil Cohen, who was a judge in Chicago, a sacrifice for both of them of which I was acutely aware. Rituals are important to me. Holidays, Sunday dinner, summer vacations at Martha's Vineyard. Perhaps because we traveled so much when I was young, I crave moments of certainty and predictability. Before moving to D.C., I had lunch with the same circle of friends every Saturday at Gibson's Bar and Steakhouse on Rush Street. We always ordered ribs to share, dry with sauce on the side, and a chopped salad for me. Once in a while, we would try a new dish, but we always reverted back to what was familiar. When I arrived in D.C., I felt yanked out of the traditions that had grounded me. We were working so hard that I didn't appreciate how unsettling the disruption was in the beginning. But over time, I began to crave new rituals and habits that would make D.C. feel like home. Having Susan across the hall was comforting. Laura's best friend, Maud, joined my team, too, and spent many a night crashing in my apartment. Susan and I left our doors unlocked so we could roam freely back and forth. Whenever my mom came to visit, she would appear at Susan's door looking for her morning cup of coffee, since I'd quit drinking coffee years earlier and never had time to go to the store to buy any for her. Those first 2 years would have been exponentially harder for me without Susan and Maud there. Our living situation became like a dorm. After a grueling night, we drank wine and ate a lot of cereal, and every day felt more challenging than our hardest final exams. In addition to Susan and Maud, I also relied on a close circle of girlfriends to give me the space to exhale. Kelly King Dibble, who had married my cousin Andrew, moved to D.C. at the start of the administration, along with Susan Curlin, who joined the Department of Transportation, and Carol Mason, who joined the Department of Justice, the one law school friend I remained close with over the 30 years since law school. We had brunch every Sunday along with my cousin Renee McCoy and sometimes Tina Chin. It reminded me fondly of my Saturday lunch routine in Chicago. Sunday family dinner was often at my cousin Tony Bush's home. She picked up the ritual begun by my parents. People often asked how I kept my spirits up at the White House for all 8 years, a record for any senior advisor in history. These special rituals are why. My other way to relax was by spending time with the Obamas. Weather permitting, we would sit on the Truman balcony, enjoying the weather and a martini or two with delicious hors d'oeuvres prepared by their extraordinary chefs. They used to make the most delicious mini open-faced BLTs with a hint of sugar. If it was just the three of us, or five with the girls, we'd sit at a round table that could comfortably hold 10. Their private dining room, which they'd redecorated to their taste and at their personal expense, could accommodate many more, so different tables were used depending on the size of the group. The flowers, always freshly prepared by the in-house florist to match the decor, were works of art, and there were actual works of art, too. One night, Susan Scher whispered to me in awe, "It's a real Monet." After dinner, we would go back to the Truman balcony or hang out in the West Sitting Parlor or the Yellow Oval Room, or we might watch a movie in the private movie theater on the ground floor of the residence. One time, when Michelle had a group of her girlfriends over, the president came into the Yellow Oval to say hello to everyone. He stayed and chatted for a bit, then he left, and when he came back a few hours later, we were all still in the same spots. "You're still talking?" he said incredulously. It reminded me of my parents' disbelief when I would spend hours talking to my high school boyfriends on the phone. We responded in unison that we never ran out of topics to discuss. My other rock of support was the one person I couldn't have imagined going to the White House without, my longtime executive assistant, Kathy Branch. I was totally dependent on her. Several months after I became commissioner in 1991, I hired her as my assistant, and from that day, Kathy took care of me in every possible way, whether it was juggling priorities on my overpacked calendar or making sure I knew Laura was on the phone whenever she called. A single mother herself, Kathy was always protective of my time with Laura against the avalanche of demands. Kathy's response when I asked her to join me in the White House was the same as when I left City Hall and asked her to join me at the Habitat Company. "Who?" she said, looking over her right shoulder and then her left. "You," I said. "I'm talking to you." "Me?" Kathy wasn't being humble or making a joke. She was genuinely in shock. A West Side Chicago native, Kathy was 25 years old when we met. She dropped out of school after becoming a mother at 16, but she was resilient and determined to make a good life for her son. While working at a temp agency, as well as at McDonald's, she was placed in the city's Department of Planning and Development, where my chief of staff, Beth, recognized her talent. 4 years later, she joined me when I moved to the Habitat Company. One day, while we were working at Habitat, Kathy stepped into my office to confide that she was having a very serious domestic upheaval. I sensed she was having trouble at home, mainly because she wasn't in her usual bubbly good spirits, and she slowly opened up and described in painful detail what she was enduring at home. I tried to be a helpful sounding board and a source of strength for Kathy. Her spirit was broken for a while, but she summoned the courage to take back control of her situation. If we had not been close enough for me to ask what was wrong, I couldn't have helped her. Kathy's journey to the White House was truly her wildest dream come true, but she picked up a bias against her before we even left Chicago. People were incredulous that I hired her to work at the White House. "How'd you get that job when you're so geeky?" someone asked her, using the slang word for Kathy's thick Southern black accent. Inside the West Wing, Kathy was a black woman without a college degree, surrounded by Harvard and Yale grads. Even some members of my handpicked team didn't appreciate her capability at first and tried to second-guess her. Over time, they grew to trust her judgment, recognizing that nobody on my team there knew me better than she did. She had her own doubts, too. Was she really qualified to be there? "I don't know what I'm doing here," she said to me early on. I had to convince her to ignore the fancy resumes of her peers and recognize that she had at least two strengths that they didn't. She had actual experience in government, and she knew me very well. "You know more than you think you know," I said. "Much more." Her tears dried up, and as she later said, "You made me feel like the smartest person in the world when I felt like the dumbest." Kathy had known the president and first lady longer than most people in the White House, from Michelle's early days in the city's Department of Planning and Development, when Michelle's office was located near Kathy's desk. While I was at the Habitat Company, Kathy would pick up my lunch at the nearby East Bank Club, where, like clockwork, she would see Barack coming down the stairs from his workout while she was walking up. He would always give her a fatherly kiss on the forehead and say, "Tell Valerie I said hello." On the first Friday after the inauguration, Kathy and I were in my office working on my already out-of-control schedule for the following week. Tina Chen, my director of public engagement, popped in from her office next door. We had all known each other for nearly two decades, and we started rehashing our first week and incredulously laughing as we tried to absorb that we all worked there. You can always hear Tina's laugh a mile away. President Obama was taking his first stroll around the second floor, and he poked his head in to see what was going on. He grinned when he saw three very familiar faces and invited us down for a visit in the Oval Office. Only Tina and I followed him out the door. He leaned back in and said, "Come on, Kathy." 2 days earlier, on the first day of work, I walked into the famous office I'd seen only from the hallway behind a rope on a White House tour. I had studied every corner of the room, including its gorgeous ceiling, still trying to absorb all that had happened to land us there. I sat on the couch in the seat nearest him. When my eye caught the president's as he sat comfortably in his chair, it was hard to keep my focus. So now, when Kathy and Tina just stood there gawking, I realized I was still gawking too. Michelle, who happened to stroll in, turned to Kathy and asked, "Kathy, what do you think about all this?" "I'm still pinching myself," she said, speaking for all of us. We sat around chatting like we always used to do until the president announced that he had to get some work done. As if on cue, Tina, Kathy, and I simultaneously stood up. "I'm not ready to go back," Michelle said. In unison, the three of us sat back down. Kathy stayed with me at the White House for the entire 8 years, and over the 25 years that we worked together, she's proved to be one of the most determined, loyal, and inspirational people I've ever known. While working in the West Wing, she went back to school, taking classes online and at night, earned her BA in 2011, and at the age of 50, her master's degree. Kathy overcame immense obstacles to succeed at the White House, but she wasn't the only woman there who struggled. About 6 months into President Obama's first term, I started to notice a troubling sign in the senior women in the White House. They weren't speaking as much or as forcefully in meetings as I knew they could. A few confided in me that they didn't feel that their input, even in their area of expertise, was being valued. Every White House is intimidating. For the staff, stakes are always high. You're working for the most powerful person in the world, and the decisions he makes have global impact. It's the ultimate pressure cooker, and nobody has a tougher job than the chief of staff. All five who worked under President Obama had different skill sets, management styles, interests, and temperaments, and Rahm Emanuel, being the first, in some ways had the most challenging job of all of them. He walked into a crumbling economy, ambitious agenda, high expectations, and a team that was talented, but many of whom had never worked together before. His bombastic style of leadership was intimidating to many. He let off steam by screaming, which was unsettling not just to those to whom it was directed, but to anyone in earshot. He didn't blow up often, but when he did, it sent shockwaves through the West Wing. He never actually yelled at me, but I found it hard to watch him make so many others squirm. It's true that Rahm was an equal opportunity screamer, but the women on the staff absorbed it personally. Perhaps the men did too, but they didn't complain. A few of the other senior men in those first years of the administration exhibited a similar bravado that, intentionally or unintentionally, also made the women feel at best left out and at worst disrespected. I had gone from being a CEO where I was the decision maker to a member of a team giving advice to the president. From my experience running a company, I learned that the strongest teams depend on the level of trust between their members. And that building trust does not happen instantaneously. It takes hard work and time. Although early on, I'm sure a few of my colleagues may have felt uncomfortable or even intimidated by my relationship and access to the president and first lady, as we all worked closely together, I sensed in most cases that the initial apprehension had faded away. I did remain sensitive to the issue throughout all 8 years. If the president asked my opinion with the team or in private, I always gave it to him, just as we all did. But I never tried to relitigate policy decisions, for that would have hurt my relationship with both the president and the team, as well as have been disruptive to our rigorously structured decision-making process. There were, however, certain sensitive operational issues that I felt needed his attention. This was one. I could see for myself the growing frustration among the senior women and felt, as the most senior woman in the White House, I had a responsibility to use my voice to make sure President Obama knew he had a problem. This was no time to remain silent. I told the president that the general macho atmosphere was causing women to feel unwelcome. "If you notice," I said to him, "in meetings the women rarely talk, and when you aren't there to ask their opinion, they are becoming increasingly mute." "That's unacceptable," he said. "They're here to tell me what they think. That's their job." "Well, they don't feel comfortable." "Then let's all talk it through," he decided, never one to dodge a tough situation. He invited over a dozen of the senior women for dinner at the White House to discuss what was going on so he could better understand the dynamic and how he could help. Before dinner, I visited each woman individually and encouraged her to be honest with him about her concerns, assuring her that the president cared about creating an inclusive culture inside the West Wing and wanted to bring out the best in all of us. The dinner was scheduled for November 5th, 2009. Earlier that day, however, 13 people were tragically killed and 32 others were injured in a mass shooting at Fort Hood, an army base in Texas. It was the first of far too many tragic mass shootings during our 8 years. Over cocktails, a few of the women wondered if the president would even show up. But not only did he come, he gave us his undivided attention for 2.5 hours, staying long after the butlers had finished serving us a delicious 3-course meal at the large formal table in the state dining room. He went around the table asking each woman to share how she felt and what changes she wanted to make. He listened to every one of the most senior women in the White House, including the Deputy Chief of Staff, Director of Domestic Policy, Chair of the President's Council of Economic Advisors, Staff Secretary, and Communications Director. They brought up the kinds of issues that are so common to women no matter what they do or where they work, that their contribution was not valued, and that when they tried to speak up, they were dismissed or ignored. As time ticked by, I could sense a growing unease in the room that we were taking up too much of his time, but he didn't seem to be in a rush, which several women later told me they found extremely reassuring. In the end, the president said he would talk to Rahm about what he'd learned at our dinner because he wanted his chief of staff's help in improving the work environment, but he also wanted them to know that he could not afford for them to shrink or fade. If they were silent when they had opinions, they were not doing their jobs. "I handpicked each one of you," he said. "This is the White House. I expect you to fight to make sure your voices are heard. It's not about you. It's about helping me make the most fully informed decisions." He asked for their patience while this was straightened out, but said that if they felt that they needed another dinner with him, they should let me know. From then on, I scheduled regular dinners with the senior women in the White House. At the end of each dinner, I asked if anyone needed another dinner with the president. The answer was always no. My question became a running joke because we all knew it was better. Which is not to say everything was perfect. There were still many times when women on the staff would show up on my doorstep on the verge of tears and I'd say, "Come in and close the door. You can cry in here, but you can't let anyone else see you cry." And I also certainly showed up on their doorsteps too. But for the women in the White House, having the president himself reassure them of their value, coupled with the strong bonds we developed with one another, gave us the courage and the confidence we needed to make our voices heard. Around the same time, Anita Dunn, President Obama's communications director and a savvy Washington insider, married to Bob Bauer, the president's personal lawyer, who became White House counsel when Anita left the White House, started picking up signs of another women's problem. The women who covered the White House for the press outlets didn't feel they were receiving enough attention either. She had run the communications shop during his campaign and knew the signs. Anita suggested I start hosting women from the press corps in my office on Friday afternoons as a casual way for us to develop a relationship without a deadline or specific goal. She thought it would help them and help me. These were important relationships and a gesture to build goodwill. I was intimidated at first since I'd not spent much time with the press, but I agreed to start doing informal get-togethers. Anita would bring up cookies from the White House mess, and it was very relaxed and fun. We moved on to hosting regular dinners with the women in the press corps, often at Riss, a favorite restaurant of mine on L Street. We would reserve a big round table in a private dining room so everyone could hear one another, and we'd have off-the-record conversations that ranged from the news of the day to our favorite new movies to the challenges of being working moms. One of the reporters even brought her daughter along when her babysitter fell through, and over the years I took delight in the reporter feeling comfortable having her daughter there, reminding me of all the work events I took Laura to when she was a child. I also enjoyed having my own special relationship with her daughter as I watched her grow up. At the end of each meal, I always reminded the reporters to call me if they thought I could help them. "I won't leak confidential matters," I said, "but if you want to know what I think, I'm happy to tell you." They did, and I hope that our rapport informed their stories. As though helping the leader of the free world weren't challenging enough, my arrival in Washington, D.C. coincided with the onset of menopause and the arrival of hot flashes. I'd always look forward to menopause because, having spent my childhood in a warm climate, I'm always cold, especially in Chicago winters. No more periods and flashes of warmth all the time sounded great to me. I thought, because the word flashes was in the name, that they would feel like a bolt of heat that would subside quickly. Nobody told me they could last forever. My pores opening up and sweat always flowing down my face and wrists. Why just those two parts of my body? Who knows? But they would arrive without warning several times a day, especially when I spoke publicly, and I was helpless to stop them. As a friend of my mother's once said, "Hot flashes are the devil." So true. Tina had them too, but just ignored the sweat and let it beat up on her face. I was much more self-conscious and tried discreetly to brush it away, convincing myself that it was visible only to me, even when my hair was so wet it stuck to my forehead. In his car, President Obama always turned the temperature up to make it feel like a hot summer day in Hawaii. If I was riding with him and a flash exploded, he simply turned up the air conditioning and handed me his handkerchief without saying a word or even looking in my direction. He just knew. Other times he would tease Tina and me in a good-natured way that only a man who knows you well, like a brother, has permission to do. But the fact that Tina and I were two of the only women in this state was also an ever-present reminder of how young most of our colleagues were. I envied them in a way, coming right from a historic campaign to begin their careers at the top, but I also knew Tina and I had a far better appreciation for the extraordinary opportunity to work in the Obama White House. I also think our age gave us a thicker skin and made it easier to absorb the inevitable attacks that came our way. I certainly learned in my time in public service in Chicago how to take a punch without withering. Early on in my time in the White House, Rick Warren, the influential pastor of Saddleback Church, a Baptist church with 22,000 members, came to see me. I was in a perpetually agitated state back then, and I began our meeting by ranting about some baseless attack by Republicans on President Obama that I can no longer remember. Pastor Rick listened and offered some gently measured advice. "Valerie, an essential quality of leadership is being able to absorb pain." Of course that rang true. We talked about how we cannot let the pain make us numb or destroy our spirit, and that we are going to know so much that others do not. We agreed that you can't control what others do, just how we react. After he left my office, I went right down to President Obama and repeated his message. It really struck a chord with us, so much so that it became a regular expression between us. "Time to absorb some pain," we'd say to each other, exchanging knowing glances. There was a whole generation of young people on the campaign and now at the White House who were my daughter's age. I cared deeply about these bright, earnest young people, and because I cared about them, I came to think of them as my children. I mothered them in the professional sense, meaning I was both supportive and set high expectations, but I also mothered them, well, like a mother. One of the many ways my day was thrown off schedule was when one of the young staff came in to have a heart-to-heart. Sometimes it was a professional issue, sometimes personal, sometimes both. The White House was like any workplace in that we had women coping with the new demands of motherhood, people experiencing the loss of a loved one, and others grappling with hard career choices. Later, I found out that Kathy and my chief of staff would draw straws to see who was stuck with the awkward task of coming into my office where someone might be crying over a breakup to say, "Senior staff meeting is happening now." Every single aspect of our life in President Obama's White House was under intense scrutiny. When Common, a Grammy Award-winning artist who worked on Sesame Street and started a foundation to help young people in poor communities become leaders, came to the White House for an evening of poetry in 2011, it set off a firestorm because of some rap lyrics he had written criticizing President Bush. It was a bogus criticism, and it didn't stop us from inviting him back multiple times. But it demonstrated the hypercritical atmosphere we were up against. When President Obama wore a tan suit, even that caused high drama, never mind when he put his feet on the desk and took his jacket off in the Oval Office. Because the stakes were so high, we demanded the highest quality of work from the White House team in everything. Back in my corporate law days, I had a boss who scolded me when the correspondence with a client was not in perfect chronological order. But I became that exacting with my staff in many ways. One of the rules was no acronyms. People loved to use jargon, especially in D.C., perhaps to show they were in the know, and they certainly saved time. Let's face it, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009 was a mouthful, but nobody in the public understood what ARRP was. I instituted another rule about emails. If it took more than two scrolls to read, it's probably a message you should deliver in person. And of course, be on time. I didn't have to say that rule out loud. People could just feel what I was thinking when they were not punctual. Those who were late to a meeting in my office knew that they would have to endure the embarrassment of walking into one that had begun at the scheduled time with whoever did show up on time. The most important rule, however, was to remember that everything we did or said at work or outside of the office reflected on the President of the United States. Perhaps not fair, but that was our reality. I made a point of delivering this message to each class of the White House interns after Strutt fired one of ours for relieving himself outside the Pentagon subway station. I also reminded my team that our memos for the president would actually be read by him, just as I had discovered earlier that Mayor Daley read mine. My mantra was, show up on time, try the best you can, learn from your mistakes, no surprises, and be good to your colleagues and all of our visitors. In addition to my job responsibilities, I became an informal conduit between the West Wing and the East Wing early on, once it became clear that the lack of coordination between the two was causing problems. This shuttle diplomacy was initially intended to keep the President and First Lady from wasting their time with coordinating schedules. In the beginning, the First Lady's chief of staff wasn't invited to senior West Wing staff meetings. This made it more difficult for the First Lady's team to plan with the amount of lead time she required. Her office often felt jammed up, trying to juggle her schedule to accommodate decisions made by the West Wing. The right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing. Tensions flared up, for example, over the easily avoidable scheduling conflict of having the president out of town when his girls had an important school activity they wanted him to attend. Simple to avoid if we talked to each other and weren't all moving at the speed of light. After the Affordable Care Act passed, Susan was promoted to the First Lady's chief of staff. Recognizing the communication problem, Rahm began inviting Susan to his morning meetings. Even with that issue solved, however, Susan and I still collaborated a lot, both formally and informally. Scheduling wasn't the only source of conflict with which we had to deal. There was also the issue of radically different management styles. Mrs. Obama required her team to give her information well in advance of any event or decision. Meanwhile, we would cram the president every night, sending him home with voluminous piles of paper he had to plow through to prepare for the next day. There wasn't a single time in 8 years when I remember the president walking into a meeting unprepared. He never once yelled at us, and he rarely complained. "You guys are killing him," Mrs. Obama kept telling Susan and me in different ways and at different times. Although he never complained to her, she certainly noticed when he climbed into bed at 2 a.m. Quite rightly, she viewed it as our job to look out for her husband, and that included not ignoring the toll the grueling schedule was taking on him. We relayed her concerns to other members of the senior staff, and we'd try to do better. We would institute new reforms. Memos would be due to the staff secretary by a certain time of day, so he wouldn't have to consume so much information into the wee hours of the night. But inevitably, we slipped back into the old ways of doing things due to the volume and urgency of time-sensitive decisions. The habit was impossible to break, though every chief of staff tried. After the bumps on the campaign, Michelle was determined to set her own pace and priorities in the White House. One of the ways she tried to establish normalcy for herself and her family was to set dinner in the White House always at 6:30 p.m. Knowing how important those dinners were to the president and the first lady, any evening that I was in the Oval Office after 6, I started feeling anxious when the clock struck 6:10. I knew we needed to wrap up by 6:25 so the president could make his 2-minute commute with time to spare. When, late in the day, people brought up thorny problems that I knew would take considerable time to resolve, I'd think to myself, how can I help move this along, and fast? Of course, the goal of all our hard work was not simply to have a better functioning White House, but to do so with the aim of serving the American people. It's no coincidence that the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act was the first bill President Obama signed. The law, which made it easier for women to bring pay discrimination suits, had been wallowing Congress for years. But Speaker Nancy Pelosi moved it along, as only she can do, once President Obama was elected. He wanted it to set the tone for his administration's priorities. My office was responsible for working with the social office to manage any event tied to the vast array of our constituency groups. The Lilly Ledbetter signing was our first time organizing an event on the state floor of the residence. For that, and for all subsequent signings, we invited the stakeholders who'd been the most involved in its passage, which, because of limited space, turned out to be a lot harder than it looked. We were never able to satisfy the demand, and I had to review the final list of invitees to make many tough calls. Even among those who made the final cut, there were always people unhappy with their seats. Before each event, my staff would tell me who was grumpy so that I could show them some love, as we called it. I tried to arrive early and walk around the room to lay hands on and spend a little time with as many of our guests as possible. I wanted the attendees to enjoy themselves, to feel we appreciated their hard work, since they were there because they had done the heavy lifting that gave reason to celebrate. On that first bill, it was all hands on deck. We scurried around frenetically at the last minute to make sure we were ready. Thankfully, the White House social aides, who were part of the permanent staff, subtly guided us when balls started to drop. Many on my team, seasoned field organizers on the campaign trail, who were used to executing complicated tasks flawlessly, were stressed out by the time the president emerged to sign the bill. Lilly Ledbetter, after whom the bill was named, looked resplendent in her signature red. She was an icon among women's rights activists for her selfless lobbying effort. The law she pushed would not benefit her because she'd already lost her Supreme Court case against her employer, Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company, for wage discrimination, but it would help countless women in the future. After the signing, Tina and I felt triumphant on a number of levels. Hoping the Lilly Ledbetter Act was just a good start, we spent much of those first months trying to figure out the best strategy for continuing our lifelong fight for gender equity. We studied past administrations and consulted a wide range of women's advocacy groups. In the end, we recommended to the president that he codify a government-wide approach using an executive order to create the first White House Council on Women and Girls. It was composed of senior officials in every agency and department. Each member of the council and their teams would evaluate all of the programs, policies, and legislation through a gender lens. This had never been done before, And when we pitched him on it, President Obama was fully supportive of the idea. He had always been surrounded by working women in both his family and at work, and he knew the playing field was far from even. He had watched both his mom